Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Busy routines can make it hard to focus on your health goals, but MedExpress offers a simple way to explore weight management treatment online. Complete our short eligibility consultation with no need for face-to-face appointments or travel. If eligible, treatment is delivered discreetly, with UK-registered clinicians offering support along the way. Visit medexpress.co.uk/podcast to get started today.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Sadia Khan. You know, I get calls from candidates and their teams asking me to support a candidate. They impress me with their credentials, their policy stance, and how it aligns with my political views. But some people come across as kinder. And when Raj Goyal called, which I'm sure he called a lot of people, I felt like at the very least, I wanted him on my podcast. The New York primary is on June 23rd, and hence there are more political conversations on Immigrantly than what you would expect otherwise. And today's is with Raj. His parents came from Bathinda, Punjab in 1971, doctors. A few dollars, the whole story. He grew up in Wichita, Kansas, Duke undergrad, Harvard Law, worked at the ACLU after 9/11, in 2006 became the first Indian American ever elected to the Kansas legislature. Ran for Congress in 2010 against, guess who? Mike Pompeo. Lost. Moved to New York. Built and sold an AI company. Founded Phone Free New York, which actually got smartphones banned in K-12 schools statewide. And now he's challenging a 20-year incumbent for the New York State Comptroller. He lives in New York with his wife, 2 teenage daughters, his mother, and his mother-in-law. That's a lot of work. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome, Raj. I'm excited to have you on Immigrant.
Thank you, Sadia.
How are you doing?
I am okay.
Okay. Did the Knicks win yesterday or no?
Is that a serious question?
That is a serious question because I am not into basketball. I don't watch it. And I did not check the news in the morning.
Fascinating. So, yes, the Knicks crushed and it was a great game. I'd say there are other cities like this, but I think the relationship that the city has to the Knicks is profound, unique, and it's actually even stronger. The Giants and the Yankees and the Jets and the Mets, they have, you know, incredibly loyal fan bases. But I would say the Knicks cuts across every line that you can imagine, you know, race, class, culture. It is an amazing thing. I mean, people are walking with an extra bounce on their step.
I know. And, you know, I thought I would have the time to check what happened at yesterday's game in the morning, and I didn't. So I apologize to all the New Yorkers. I'm sorry. I'm still into cricket and tennis.
Yes.
And F1 is something that I latched on to recently.
Interesting. Oh, so you're a sports person.
Not a sports person. Yeah. I just like a few. Did you grow up watching basketball?
Yeah, was that something that you liked? I grew up as Sports Illustrated?
Yeah.
Of course. So, you know, I would call it like an SI kid. I mean, this is the 80s. We were, you know, there's obviously no internet. There's no cell phones. And so I was completely sports nut kid with my buddies. And we were throwing the football in the backyard every day. you know, I played as many sports as I could. I was a decent athlete, but let's call it decent at best. Uh-huh. and I was, you know, I'd say the main sport. I mean, I played football for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Played, you know, basketball and then I played tennis mostly.
Were you ever interested in cricket?
I only know cricket to the extent that I would visit India, and my cousins, of course, would. So I've watched cricket, of course, and I love the fact that it's becoming a big thing here. Like that big game out in Long Island, what was it? Oh, it was India-Pakistan.
Right,
what am I saying?
Right.
Yeah, of course. Excuse me. Yeah. And so from my vantage point, it's grown exponentially. My friends who are in the sports world, they tell me that it's growing. I'll say I monitor it at the very highest level. I know who Sachin Tendulkar is, you know, which is kind of like
Raj,
saying,
you have to catch up on a lot.
Yeah. That's like saying, you know, who Michael Jordan is, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I look at it more since I grew up here, and it is not something that is, you know, I'm a big college. I went to Duke for college. I'm a big college basketball guy, big football fan. Obviously a basketball fan and tennis guy. So, you know, it is...
I get it. Yeah. I mean, I have two girls who were born and raised here, not interested in cricket
How
at
old
all.
Are they?
Oh my gosh. One is 20 and the other one is 23.
You have two daughters who are 20 and 23?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay, that's incredible. You must have started when you were 10 years old. I have two daughters as well. And
I'll
talk about
that.
Yeah, 14 and 16.
You know, we could talk about that for forever.
Forever.
I don't know. I mean, raising daughters. I talked to Ashley, our sound engineer, about that a lot. But we could have another podcast about that.
In fact, I got to say, my family supports this campaign fully and totally, and we're a very, very close family, and we're going to talk about this. We live actually with my mother-in-law and my mother, so the multi-generational thing is very, very important to me, and I'd love to explore that. But I'm going to say this other, I miss them so much because I'm sort of out in the morning and I'm gone all day, and I've missed a lot of milestones. In fact, tomorrow is my 14-year-old's 8th grade graduation.
Oh.
And at her school, they make a huge deal of it. And they do a really, really nice job with it. And I'm certainly excited to be there tomorrow morning.
And you will be there.
Yes. And I'll definitely have some Kleenex with me.
And you'll try not to embarrass them.
I will try not to embarrass
them. Right.
But that is, I don't know if I can do that.
Okay, let's talk about your parents. They're from India. They moved from Bhatinda. Is that correct?
Yes. I am unusual, I would say, in this regard, which is I have done 20 hours of filming in 1997 of my family history. So when I left college, I had done a ton of traveling and I had a bunch of friends and we were partying around. But I did something unusual, which is right after college, instead of doing sort of the big trip, I went on my own to Punjab and I went deep into family history and I have sort of become the self-appointed family historian. I've taken a huge amount of oral history over the years. And so Bhatinda is, in fact, our WhatsApp group is called the Bhatinda Cuz Connection.
I love that.
And so it's a very, very big, big part of our lives. And I have to say I'm very, very somber, but I lost my Mamaji last week.
Oh, and so, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah, in fact, on the way here, WhatsApp, you know, the cousin group, they had just sent some images of his memorial, and I was sort of having a moment on the subway there. My colleague who works with me was probably wondering what was going on. And so Bhatinda is really the house that my parents were married in, that my mother was born in, that her sisters, she has five sisters. My mom's now 83, but her eldest sister is 90. And still alive. I'll talk about it as well. It's not easy for me, but I lost my father several years ago. And my father-in-law, of course, in South Asian diaspora, we have this concept of taking care of the elders. In America, it gets a little bit scrambled. And I think that for our generation, what happened is that the emphasis was so extraordinary on success. My father worked so hard. He came from nothing. He was like almost a village kid. And what happened is he just, you know, he was a physician, but he just came from nothing. He served in a war. He served in the villages. Really, for even an Indian American immigrant story, his is very unique. And he was just so just hell-bent on making something of himself. And he was kind and gentle, but gosh, he wanted to work. And so he would just sacrifice anything. You know, they just didn't prioritize what we would call the soft stuff. And I don't mean that interpersonally. I mean that in terms of like, gosh, it'd be great to be together more. Or, you know, he was like, look, if you have to go to Siberia to, you know, get the training that you need and it's personally difficult, you just have to do it.
And I wonder if that's generational or if that's an immigrant thing, because I am an immigrant. My husband is an immigrant. And this mentality of we took such a big risk and we came to the U.S. with nothing.
It's amazing. Just amazing.
We have to make it work.
Yes.
And we have to make it work not just for ourselves, but for our relatives who are back in Pakistan, in our case, and judging us for leaving Pakistan. So I think it's just this idea of self-validation and how do we achieve that through success in the U.S. I do want to talk about your parents coming to Rochester.
Yes.
But then they eventually moved to Wichita, Kansas. Midwest. Every time I think of an immigrant living in Midwest, and a lot of them do, I'm like, what was that experience like?
So yes, mom and dad, before I'm in the picture, moved with my then 3-year-old brother, who's now 58. They moved to Rochester. My aunt, my Masi, and her husband. And actually, this is the stage of life where we lost my uncle a year ago, and he was my closest uncle to me, and miss him dearly. He was very political. So they were in Rochester, you know, it was a hub for all these Desis, doctors, engineers, what have you, you know. And so mom and dad go there, they do their medical training, and then they rattle around from apartment to apartment chasing training. I'm born in Cleveland because my father's dream was to study at the Cleveland Clinic as a cardiologist. He accomplished that. And then my father's best pal, who's an Argentinian, who's still alive, Carlos Salgado, he had discovered Wichita. And he, as the story goes, he calls my dad and says, Christian, I found a place where we can set up a practice. And my dad said, what's a Wichita? don't know if it's true, but, you know, it's maybe an apocryphal story now. So that's where we were raised. I think I moved when I was 9 months old, started in an apartment, and mom and dad. Can you imagine my mother being an obstetrician was the only female, forget even being foreign born, accented, brown skinned. She was the only female doctor delivering babies. You know, at that time in the 70s, you know, obstetrics was purely male dominated.
But I heard that people would not refer patients to them.
Oh, definitely not. I mean,
your mother built her practice with Filipino American doctors. Is that true?
Yes. What an amazing research you've done. Yes. It's an amazing story. Yeah. Of course, they were shut out from sort of the power structure. Mm. Always felt different. And, you know, to your point about immigrants and the identity that you feel like you have to be better, you have to be, that's why my father had, and my mother had incredible training. They went to Ames and they didn't just get MBBSs, they got MDs. And my father had an MBBS and an MD. And so my mother, yes, they were sort of in that referral network. She's ended up practicing with Filipinos. And then let me add another wrinkle, which is by the end of their time practicing, all Vietnamese patients.
Because
the Vietnamese community, which is very, very strong and large, you get to another immigrant diaspora and another wrinkle to this complexity, which is in the South Asian diaspora, you had a lot of professional immigrants.
Hmm. Yeah.
In the East Asian diaspora, where I was raised, it was more of a working class community that would attracted a lot of Vietnamese and Cambodians and Laotians were the airplane factories, the aviation factories. And so, interestingly, and there were very few physicians in the community. And so my mother and father, being Asian American, of course, had relationships. And so they ended up being the referral. So the referral network, if you can imagine, that is typical. They were shut out of the power structure. But they sort of built an alternative one by accident and by necessity.
But immigrants helping immigrants, right? Isn't that such an endearing story? So did your mom or dad ever tell you this story? Or what was their understanding of how they viewed their success in the U.S.? Did they ever talk to you about this?
Oh, yeah, sure. My father was, in many ways, I think, always wanting more. I think I probably have inherited a fair amount of that.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, always wanting to go and achieve and have an impact. And so, you know, my dad was, unfortunately, I think maybe sometimes deprecating and downplaying how much he had accomplished. And he was a very, very brilliant man. I think anybody would acknowledge was in a room full of doctors. He had always done his research. He had great instincts. He had just had this, he was a doctor. One of those, you know, he was somebody who lived to practice medicine. It's what he sustained him, and it's what fueled him, and he did it at the highest level. And so, you know, but he would have loved, I mean, let's be frank, he would have loved to have had more maybe recognition, maybe sort of gotten farther in the profession. Now, he gave his patients the shirt off his back, you know, and, you know, I can tear up thinking about all the residents he trained, because I'd say your dad would stay late and he'd mentor me and so on. So he was that kind of guy. But, you know, sure, he had no money and he needed to pay for his kids. And so he had to set up shop wherever he could.
But then you went to law school.
Well, my older brother went to law school and sort of blazed a bit of a trail for me in terms of not going on the medical route. And but I was always, from a very, very young age, driven to public service and driven to sort of these leadership roles. I don't know why or how. My joke is that my mom dropped me on my head as a kid, but of course, she's an obstetrician, so that's not very funny to her. Of course, my trial lawyer friends, they love that joke. They're like, they, you know. It is one of those things. You never know where these sparks come from. And I was just always, you know, obviously the academic success I was blessed to have, and it was a priority for me. But I also was very social and always, you know, surrounded by people, and it was important to me, and also always very focused on trying to make an impact. And, you know, on the immigrant front, you know, maybe that was, they never talked about it. There's never an explicit conversation. Raj, we expect you to do Y.
I'm surprised, though. Like, a lot of immigrant parents are very explicit in terms of success. So maybe your parents were nicer, gentler.
Yes, I mean, we had high expectations and they worked so hard. And so I think it was one of those things where I just sort of consumed the ethos of how hard they had to struggle. And I was, my older brother, you know, he's an immigrant himself. He's a naturalized citizen. I'm the first of my family born in this country. And so, you know, I think that we had this chip on our shoulder, this notion of just sort of having to, like, we had to overcome and do more. And I just know it wasn't easy. And that's why it was so important to me to sort of plumb into the history of my mom and dad and the entire family story. And in fact, whenever I have some space in my life, I have some things I definitely plan to write and plan to develop around all that material.
Anything fascinating you found through that research?
My father was literally raised in an open-air abandoned building that they called the Machine in Ramamundi, which is a village outside of Batinda. And then I went to the actual village of village called Narang, where my father was born. And even in 1997, it was difficult to get to. Back in the day, they could only go by donkey. And even in 1997, the primitive conditions there were people literally living in mud huts. And we drove up, and that's where my father was born. And so, you know, my mother's family was a little bit more well off, and they had a grain business, but it was still India in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, very, very backwards. And, you know, now, as I mentioned, we lost my mamaji just last week. So we don't even know that house. I was just there last year, and it's that iconic joint family house that's been almost 100 years in the family, the businesses and the grain market. So these are the kind of stories that come to mind, these little touch points, you know, where that village where my father was born, the house where my mother's family is, it's still iconic and still there. And they've done some renovations, and they had a buffalo when my mom grew up, and they would literally just milk it, you know, all of those things.
I want to circle back to something you just said. We were talking about your academic accomplishments, and you said you were blessed. Interesting choice of words. You were hardworking, probably, right? So you're not giving yourself full credit.
Yes, I guess I was always a good student, and it was important to me, and I worked hard at it. It also came to me. Nothing is easy. I think what surprised my parents, is that maybe they expected academic success. What they didn't expect that is also student body president. And that I was sort of this leader on social causes. I protested at a chemical factory, protested the pro-life movement in our city at age 15. I was just very engaged in political life.
How did they view that?
I think the irony, of course, is that they've ended up being very political. But they were Democrats. And here in New York, that's like something obvious. But you can imagine this is didn't even use the term at the time, but the reddest part of the country. And they became citizens in 1979. They cast their first vote for Jimmy Carter in 1980. And that was, so we were always swimming against the tide. That's where I sort of have, I think, probably that in my deep heart's core, which is we can make change, we can work, we can, you know, just climb the highest mountain if you can. And, and maybe that's why I'm, in this campaign even right now.
Raj, but politics is messy, right? And you started it early on. You ran against Mike Pompeo. You lost. But then you moved to New York. What did that loss teach you at the time?
Well, I tell you, if I could, backing up even a little bit more. So I went on my journey, and it was my dream and my passion to be a civil rights lawyer. And I have read and studied a tremendous amount, and I felt connected in a sense to the civil rights movement. I knew very much about the connection between Dr. King and learning from nonviolent civil disobedience and Satyagraha of the independence movement in India. I worked in South Africa. Truth Commission for Archbishop Tutu. And of course, that's where Gandhi got his start and Peter Maritzburg and so on. And so I felt very connected to that. And I accomplished that goal and that dream of being, I worked at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Did you work at ACLU as well?
And of course, yes. Then I spent very formidable time at the ACLU right after 9/11. So yes, I represented a lot of Muslim South Asians and advocate for them when the Bush administration was targeting them. So all of that, and then I went to an organization in Washington to fight the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq and to work on civil rights and to work on immigration. We defeated the mass deportation policy of the Bush administration. But I wanted to do more, and I wanted to be closer to my parents. So I went back to my hometown, and I did so because I wanted to prove that progressive politics could win in the hardest place, and we did.
And you did,
and we did. And so when I won probably the biggest election for State House Democrats in the country in 2006, and I knocked 8,000 doors, and I didn't change my name, I didn't change my religion.
I'm so glad you did not change your name and your religion.
Here's the funny part. They wanted to, my full name is Rajiv, which I'm very, very happy, proud of. I've just gone by Raj, in terms of a nickname, maybe a Bob Robert sort of thing. And they kept, in all their attacks, they'd always call me Rajiv, the real Rajiv.
They thought you were somehow hiding something.
Well, of course, but also they wanted, I'm going to coin a phrase here, foreignize me, right? They wanted to show this, because that's an odd name, particularly there. And so, so in any case, I served 4 years did a lot of great work there, and then ended up running for the U.S. House. And Mike Pompeo called me, a turban topper and a communist and a terrorist, and they darkened our photos. And so I think to some extent, I sort of just internalized all that and just have a very thick skin on all that. And that's good for politics. New York is such an important part of our story. And I'd love to talk about the fact that, my parents moved here and then my in-laws moved here. And
so they moved here first.
So this is after, so I lose that race.
And then you moved to New York.
I moved to New York. My wife is totally a New Yorker. She's from Orange County. Her parents were public school teachers for 30 years, Orange County. And then my late father-in-law and my mother-in-law are just tremendous salt of the earth community folks. They built the Indian Mundir off the thruway in Orange County. My father-in-law was just the community person. Thousands and thousands of hours, for the community and bringing people together, just revered and loved. And we dearly, dearly miss him. And so we wanted to be in New York. We sort of always knew we'd end up in New York. And so I came a little bit, chastened after that loss. And I ended up working a lot in the South Asian diaspora. I was actually an advisor to a foundation. We were funding groups like Saki and Saya and Chaya and a lot in the LGBTQ space and so on. And then I connected with an old friend and I cooked up an idea for a legal technology company.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So you built a company, you founded it, you sold it. AI?
Machine learning, but yes.
What was that experience like, being an entrepreneur?
Yes, I mean, you know, many, many people would ask me, so wait, you were a state representative and now you're a tech co-founder and CEO. And I would say, look, I find it a very consistent journey and a through line, which is when I see a problem, I want to solve it. And I think there is a big problem in corporate waste in these budgets. And actually, the legal system, I think, is horribly in need of reform. And the legal system is one that doesn't serve our country, our society very well. That's what it's made to do. And it just unfortunately is in a place, nobody's fault really, it's just sort of one of those systems that spiraled. So you have a huge demand of need for people who can't access the system. You have extraordinarily expensive lawyers. You have, I have an entire, that's a whole nother podcast, how our legal system should be far more responsive to our citizenry and to its needs. And so that was the animus, the animating factor in the company. But, you know, we were a corporate company and we built software and we sold software and we delivered for our clients and we delivered for our investors and so on. So it was a great private sector experience. Co-founded Impact and originated the idea, which is the largest South Asian political organization now in the country. We've elected hundreds of South Asians up and down the ballot. I was on the board of Planned Parenthood here. I was on the board of several other nonprofits. And so I think my business colleagues were probably a little bit wanting me to focus less on that.
How do you square that, like being on the inside, on the corporate side, especially tech entrepreneur? People are skeptical now, right?
Yes, they should be.
They are, right?
They should be.
But then you're also running to be the New York State comptroller.
Yes.
Would that be considered on the outside, looking in?
Well, I put it this way, which is I learned a lot. And of course, managing the state's finances, I'm very excited to do. And right now, I think they should be done in a much better way, which is why I'm running, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But the private sector experience I've had has trained me in so much of what needs to be corrected in the private sector. And so, you know, with that experience, now I know sort of where the bodies
are. Correct?
Where the bodies are buried. And so I see the excesses of Wall Street. I see and I saw very much like what happens, you know, you take private equity, for example. You know, private equity is now in youth sports, in housing, in buying emergency rooms. Well, I've seen how that industry works. It is not appropriate. It is not good for anybody, but we have this financialization. We have this financial Wall Street mindset that has taken over everything, of course, with Donald Trump's exorbitantly grotesque corruption in every possible way, not only for his family, but just loosening the rules. We have, you know, sadly, we have a real life example with SpaceX. We will all be jammed. There's hundreds of millions of people who have index funds.
There's a controversy around NASDAQ and SpaceX right now.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about
just,
that?
Just so what happens is there's very important investor protections around how you get listed into the index funds and when you can sell your shares and so on. And so Elon Musk has bullied his way into bending the rules, and it affects all of us. And because we have, of course, have a federal government that is completely owned and operated by Trump Inc., of course, they've relaxed all these things.
Hey everyone, it's Olivia Culpo, and I can't wait to tell you all about Abercrombie's new summer collection. All their new dresses and colorful swim feel perfect for a Euro summer, and Abercrombie has a new 100% linen collection. It's the perfect mix of looking put together and elevated with the lightness and comfort of linen. Shop Abercrombie this summer in the app, online, and in stores.
So let's talk about the role of a New York State comptroller.
Sure.
Right? As a comptroller, you'll be managing a $300 billion fund. That's huge, Raj. You have an incumbent who's been doing that for 20 years.
Yes.
Some people may say, why fix something that's not broken? because people are okay with him. Like, the union workers are fine with him. The retirees like him. But I also see the generational shift happening, right? There are present retirees and then there are future retirees.
Yes.
And they have a very different approach. But as going back to you being New York State Comptroller, you will be investing in index funds. How much control do you think a comptroller has in what different stocks that index fund invests in?
It's a great set of questions. And so, you know, Tom DiNapoli, the current incumbent, had no financial background whatsoever, was a backbencher in the assembly and then selected by the then speaker, and, you know, going to jail for his for his own corruption. And so that's the origin story there. And so I think my mix of both public and private experience is the exact right combination for what the modern era of being a comptroller demands. And so the state comptroller, yes, runs a $300 billion pension fund. I think that to your point, of course, the establishment is supporting a longtime incumbent. There's no surprise there. I think we've been excited by the number of endorsements and energy that we're kicking up, and especially with just 19 days to go. In terms of the index fund, which is right now, the current incumbent is spending $1 billion on Wall Street fees that really aren't making money for the fund. That's an outrage, and that's something that needs to be stopped, because we could be growing the fund. It should be a bigger fund. Of course, I'm happy that the fund is not insolvent, but remember that the reason that's the case is that if the fund is performing poorly, then taxes are raised. So it's really a balance. And so what's happening is if you turn one dial down, the other dial has to go up.
Nobody wants the fund to underperform.
Correct.
Because then the taxes will go up.
That's
right. People don't like higher taxes. But how do you ensure that the fund is performing well, being more intentional about what stocks to invest in? Because I'll give you an example of Palantir.
Yes,
I know you've talked about it,
yes.
Which, I mean, I despise the company. I just want to say it. I wanted to preface it with that. But at the end of the day, the question then becomes, how do you square morality with prioritizing?
Two things. So number one is, especially in a public pension fund, everything is intentional. So Tom DiNapoli himself, after much pressure, divested from gun manufacturing after Sandy Hook. On the foreign bond portfolio, for political reasons, he has over $350 million in Israel. And that does not really financially make any sense. The rest of the world has less than $300 million. So he's making political decisions each and every day. And so Palantir, yes, is in the S&P. He, though, proactively bought a huge amount of, using our money, bought a bunch of stock in Palantir, and then tripled that position. And at a time when ICE's reign of terror was very, very evident. And so the short answer is we can actually grow the pension fund. There are plenty of great companies to invest in that aren't Palantir, that are good growth companies and that when we get great returns, that don't violate our values. And that's why I've said also the pension fund should divest from fossil fuels. The New York City pension fund did so and has performed admirably. I think for people who oppose, who lack the political will, it is a bit of an excuse,
right,
to say, well, I don't know. I think everything should just be for return. Of course, we should have a great return. And in fact, under a Goyle administration, we'd have better returns than we do under the incumbent. We can also protect our values. And we can invest in affordable housing. You know, I've talked a lot about the fact that we can build hundreds of thousands of affordable homes all across the state. And we can invest directly, because that's the right thing to do, and it's a good return. And so that's, I think, when you talk about sort of this generational change, of course, retirees, they need to be protected, and I will stop at nothing to protect them. And look, I'm the son-in-law of two retirees who are teachers for 30 years.
Right.
You know, they're in NYSTERS. That's actually not part of the New York State Comptroller's Office. They're in their own fund. But, you know, it's very, very important that we protect the retirees.
Talk to me a little bit about the generational shift that we are seeing.
Well, I think what's happening is we need better Democrats, and we need Democrats who fight. And that's really what we're seeing in primary after primary. And that's what's, I think, happening in my race as well, which is people are hungry for people who are going to fight this affordability crisis that's choking New Yorkers, choking everybody, and that will fight the Trump administration. I mean, Palantir is ICE's software partner. There's no business we should be in that stock. We should be using the audit power to look at every single county and local agreement to see that we're not helping commenting on detention, on warehousing. You know, I was at Delaney Hall on Sunday. And, you know, what's amazing about Delaney Hall is that I was there for, you know, about an hour, hour and a half, and it was super peaceful. We were literally singing peaceful protest songs, and the police just unnecessarily cleared it out. And it was obviously a suppression tactic. It wasn't needed to preserve public safety. And so that's the kind of culture we have. You know, one thing I was talking about is that one of the reasons I got in this race, Abby, is that my mother, who I've talked about, who's now a widow, of course, and was used to run a small business and a grandmother of five, she's worried that she would be deported.
And that's so heartbreaking, right? After being naturalized for almost 50 years. Yeah. But why New York State Comptroller? Why not House or Senate again?
I mean, look, this was a job that I've long eyed because I hate wasting political power when we could be fighting for good values. And this is, to me, the embodiment of wasted political power. And so that's why this office is so powerful in my view. And I think it's a clear case where we can upgrade, you know, and I salute Tom's years of service, but it is time. I mean, he's been a politician longer than I've been alive. And also more broadly, Democrats have been very poor at identifying these fiscal money offices. The Republicans, the chief fiscal officer of every red state, they're in an organization. It's called the SFOF. They, you know, go around and they have their conferences and industry wines and dines. They rail against, quote, woke CEOs. As I like to say, I don't think we need a war on woke. We need a war on broke. You know, that's what we need. And so I will, of course, you know, organize the blue state pension funds so that we can fight back and protect our values. And most importantly, protect our pensioners. And that's the vision I think that people have of this office, of the way that Democrats should act right now, as opposed to going along and getting along.
So you've been running this campaign for a while now. What are some of the conversations that you've had with folks that really resonated?
I think when people tell me that, look, they're just looking for government to, and the political system to be responsive to the fact that they can't afford their utility bill. You know, I'm focused like a laser. That's the issue probably I've talked about most, which is getting under the hood of Con Ed and National Grid and, you know, and PSE&G, because those books are cooked. There is no reason that we're paying more and more and more for our electricity bills, delivery charges. And it's because there's this little obscure agency that's very powerful in Albany that Tom DiNapoli refuses to audit, that he refuses to expose. We have these AI data centers all over the state that are cropping up. I support a moratorium on that. And so when people tell me, like, hey, what's happening? Why is this data center coming into my neighborhood? What's changed on the delivery charges? Why is that going up on my National Grid bill? My kids can't get a job. We have a real problem that isn't getting enough attention about the fact, particularly people in their early 20s, mid-20s. It's kind of bleak out there. We need to make sure that obviously New York City and New York State thrives in the industries that we can.
I do want to circle back to AI. As a small organization, I feel like AI has been a blessing for us in many ways, right? Because a lot of stuff that we could not do otherwise, AI facilitates that. It saves time, money. As a startup, I feel Immigrantly has benefited from AI.
I read this morning the MTA is looking at some AI tools that can detect when people fall under the tracks. How about detecting disease? You know, think about radiology. You know, the machine can see things, the human eye can't.
But at the same time, I see that conversations around AI, the technology itself, you talked about data centers, and that's a concern to have. But how do you square the benefits versus the risks of AI? Because in my mind, AI is here to stay. How do we embrace the technology and also be more intentional about it?
I think that's where we need to have a much more robust discussion in public life around it. I mean, I'll just have to say this, my opponent, the current incumbent, doesn't use a computer.
Oh, he doesn't?
No, he has his assistant print the emails out for him. Now,
interesting.
Well, I just think that's a tell. I mean, if you need somebody who's...
I mean, look, my dad is 80 and he is on Twitter all the time.
Yes.
So it's not generational,
no,
guys.
No, it's not generational. No, it's a mindset. And so what I would say is on AI, many people, my good friend Ro Khanna, who's endorsed me, Ro has a very thoughtful framework. I've thought a lot about these issues, which is, let's take Uber as an example. Uber comes into being, and there's clearly a market demand for ride sharing, and ride sharing has transformed our world. And it's clear that the taxi industry and that the taxi setup and TLCs and so on were not matching the need. And that's why even they had to have outer borough taxis. What we saw there were billions of dollars from venture capitalists and big tech come in and subsidize and basically start getting drivers onto a platform because they knew that they would basically use market leverage to crush the existing order, flood the streets with Ubers and with ride sharing. And of course, there was huge demand for it. But how do we set up a proper set of guardrails and rules? One thing I always talk about, Austin, Texas, banned Uber for a while, and they set up, there was a nonprofit called Ride Austin. It was the same thing. The driver suicides, we had crushing debt. We had to then deal with this enormous social impact and this negative aftermath of just allowing technology to run amok. And so I think what's very clear is we need to talk about the impact on jobs and employment. We have to talk about the ethical guardrails. I mean, of course, we can't have these machines just running rampant without any checks. We see what they can do. We see how they can manipulate. We see how dangerous coding can lead. And so I think that's what we're, and I think what's interesting is there's this congressional primary here in New York. Alex Borres is a friend of mine, and he's running against several other folks. You know, it's at least we're having these debates. That's in the context of a political campaign. But I want to see a very thoughtful framework laid out in terms of here are the guardrails that are what's how we're going to protect society and the economy. And if it means, Sadia, that we actually don't go forward in certain sectors and that we put a pause and a break on it, that's okay. And I think that we have such a go, go, go culture. And of course, I'm an innovation guy and I've been in tech and I embrace that, but I'm a dad first. I'm a human being first. I'm a member of society first and I'm a policymaker. And obviously, should we win in 19 days, inshallah, you know, have a lot more influence than we do now. And so that's the way I think about it.
So let's talk about that. How are you feeling? 19 more days to go.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're excited. If anybody tells you that campaigns are easy, they're lying. It is not the easiest thing. I will say, and if I could, I mentioned it earlier, and it's been such a wonderful conversation. I have to say, if campaigning was talking to you all day, I would do nothing but campaigning. One of the things is I mentioned about caretaking. So, you know, the hardest thing I've done in my life was take care of my dad as he was dying. And I took on that responsibility and really embraced it. And it was important to me. And I was able to be there for my family and for him. You can't cheat death. And you can't, you know, my father was 88. And he was, as I said, a brilliant doctor, but, you know, he died of congestive heart failure, the deep irony that he was a deep expert on cardiology. And so he went as far as he could. And one of the things that I think I tried during that time to study as much grief and mourning as I could. And, you know, one thing is I think that in the Jewish faith, to the extent I've learned, and I'm by no means an expert, is they have a real admirable set of rules around death and mourning and grief. And I think in the South Asian diaspora, we lack that.
Yeah.
And I think what we do is we have a deep emotional response as is natural. We have a lot of formality and a lot of ritual.
Absolutely.
And very little processing around what this caretaking and this grief does. And I think it's a larger problem in society. One analogy I always say is that when... maybe it's with a mom who delivered 5,000 babies. But, you know, back in the day, it was this notion that, you know, the woman goes and delivers a baby. The dad is at the bar drinking, you know, and then she's just supposed to get back to her home duties. And the dad is and now what we realize, and of course, there's still so much more we have to do. But now we realize that it's both exciting and amazing, but it's a trauma.
Oh, my gosh.
It's economic.
Yes.
It's personal. It's emotional. It's mental. And so we have very important policies that we need to strengthen that are still inadequate, but that we have a recognition in society that it is something important. And that is the person who's not giving birth is also in part of that and needs leave and so on. Well, I think around caretaking, like when your kid is sick or your loved one is sick or your sibling or your parent, we sort of just say, oh, I'm sorry. And then we sort of say, are you coming back to work on Thursday?
That's true.
Or, you know, yeah. And people oftentimes have to fly at the age I'm at. People are dealing with all, obviously, elderly parents and young kids. I'm very proud of the caretaking that our family has done, my wife and I salute and applaud all of the other caretakers out there. And it's one of the things that, you know, I've talked a lot about to the extent I've been able in the campaign.
In the end, Raj, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I would say that America at its core is about a community that thrives. And the reason I say that is that community is at the core of how we meld all these different people. There's no country that has ever done what America has done and continues to do. And I think thriving is really being able to afford living here. You know, I talk about being the affordability watchdog in this role, and that notion of forward success and growing so that our children live a better life than we do, that's at the core of America as well. And so it is really, and maybe that's part of the immigrant mindset that I have, but it's a community that thrives.
I love it. And by the way, congratulations on creating the joint family system in the U.S.
Well, thank you. You know, it was a lot of work, and I'm really glad that Monica and I were able to do that. And I can't believe I've gone this whole time. I know we're at the end here, but you know, Monica, my wife, is hard to describe. I mean, she's extraordinarily successful, and she's just very, very supportive. And we've been a team now for 27 years.
Where can people find information about your campaign, Raj?
They can go to rajgoyle.com and Instagram, rajgoyleny. And I'd be grateful for everybody to check it out. And of course, I'm the only child of immigrants on the ballot in my race, you know, and of course, protecting immigrants and talking about these issues and embracing our diaspora is a huge part of who I am and why I'm running and why I think we need change in this office.
I love it. Wishing you the best of luck.
Well, thank you.
Manifesting it for you here on Immigrant Key.
Well, I really, as I said, if this was what I could do all day, this is a lovely conversation. You're an amazing entrepreneur, an advocate, an immigrant, and interlocutor. So thank you for having me. It's been a real joy.
Thank you, Raj. I keep coming back to his mother, practicing medicine alongside Filipino-American women because the door was shut, eventually serving a community of Vietnamese immigrants. You know what? That's just what people do when they decide the door being shut for them doesn't mean it stays shut for everyone. Whether that translates to managing a $300 billion pension fund. That's for you to decide. Learn more about Raj and don't forget to register and vote. And remember, if you like this episode, give us a thumbs up, maybe a 5-star review, share it with a friend, a skeptic, and come back next week for another Immigrantly episode. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back for another incredible Immigrantly conversation and be kind to others.